Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents From Madness to Mindfulness, Reinventing Sex for Women by Jennifer Gonzalez, Ph.D. Narrated by Wendy Tremont King.
Introduction. I was sitting in the dark near the back of one of the fourth grade classrooms. Some of our moms were there, including mine, along with our teachers. Well, the female fourth grade teachers. The boys were in another classroom with the one male teacher. I don't know what they were doing. Nobody talked about it. We, however, were watching a cartoon about menstruation. And at the age of 10, this was the first time I was hearing about it. The movie was biology-based, with nothing overtly graphic. Nonetheless, it was not sitting well with me. What the hell was this thing that was going to happen to me? I started feeling warm and uncomfortable in my chair. I tried to distract myself by listening to the flip, flip, flip of the projector. I'd never felt this kind of visceral, slow-building nausea, although I was no stranger to car sickness. I was wearing my favorite red sweater, a button-down that I wore as a cape, with only the top button fastened, but even so, it was too warm. I took it off. I started taking deep breaths. I stared at the tiled pattern on the floor, willing myself to be okay. You're fine. You feel okay. Really, you're fine. Then I threw up all over the floor, and I started crying. The lights came on, but I saw nothing. The next thing I remember is sitting outside on the wooden bench on the elementary school's front porch, doubled over, crying. My mom was calmly telling me that I probably wouldn't have to worry about getting my period for another few years. Even in writing this story, some 34 years later, I feel the hollowness of humiliation in my heart and solar plexus, and a rising warmth and lightheadedness from shame. But over the years, I've gained skills in how to sit with this kind of discomfort and not allow it to shut me down. This book is for the many women who have internalized the madness of negative messages in small ways or big ones. By madness, I mean the huge and continuous barrage of conflicting and undermining messages we girls and women receive about our sexuality and bodies. You're too fat, too skinny, too tall, too short, too muscular, too weak, too pale, too dark, too slutty, too prudish, and the list goes on. There is always something wrong with us, which we may hear from parents, partners, the media, strangers on the street, or our own inner dialogue. We are taught to dislike ourselves, viewing me as the enemy. Sex is complicated. Although its innate purpose is procreation, we all know it has a lot of other meanings and purposes, such as pleasure, fun, and connection. Sexuality refers to the full experience of being a sexual person, including beliefs, experiences, attractions, emotions, neurochemicals, activities, and pleasure. Unfortunately, so many women in the United States struggle to enjoy their own sexuality. In addressing this problem, we often ask the wrong questions, and therefore arrive at the wrong solutions. Then the problem is perpetuated and unwittingly passed down to each generation. With the continual messages we receive, urging us to dislike our bodies and feel shame about our sexual expression or lack thereof, it is the rare woman who experiences an active, healthy, expressive, and satisfying sex life in a long-term relationship. But there is hope. This book is about reinventing sex for women. I believe that rather than focusing on pleasure or the inability to achieve pleasure, we must first focus on discomfort. This does not sound sexy, but please follow along with me. In order to experience a depth of pleasure and satisfaction, women must first explore and understand the negative messages around sex and their bodies that they learned growing up, and lean into this discomfort. In fourth grade, when I threw up at the thought of a period, I didn't have the skills to sit with the discomfort and then process it through in a healthy way. I was left with shame and embarrassment about my body, menstruation, and the whole experience. Most of us have a lifetime of such uncomfortable experiences around our sexuality, experiences that build up over time and create a barrier to satisfying sexual interactions. When I use the term, sit with the discomfort, I'm referring to the ability to notice uncomfortable thoughts or emotions, articulate what they are to yourself or another. Accept that the discomfort is happening in that moment, even if you don't like it. And choose to notice all of that instead of shutting it out or distracting yourself. This process might sound confusing, terrible, or impossible. But I assure you, it's quite possible, quite empowering, and a skill I will be teaching throughout this book. There's a lot of advice out there about how to reinvent your sex life. But the media's focus on how to have more powerful orgasms or pleasing your partner in 10 new ways is simplistic and unrealistic for better sex because it only looks at half of the equation, pleasure. It ignores the importance of understanding the thoughts, emotions, and feelings about sex that may be scary and uncomfortable, the real source of women's concerns. Throughout this book, I'll discuss the idea of noticing your thoughts and emotions and choosing to focus your attention on them, what I call staying present. In our pill-popping, magic bullet society, we are often sold simple solutions that distract us from our discomfort. However, the solution to sexual issues is to do the difficult work of creating a deeper understanding of ourselves. This means being aware at new levels we may not have known were possible. Exploring nuances of self-awareness has the potential to help those of us who feel sexually disempowered, confused, or unhappy. With such mindfulness, we can all create our own version of sexuality that is personally empowering. If you are a woman who is totally comfortable with your sexuality and body, if you move with ease and mindful awareness in sexual situations and communication, if you are comfortable being vulnerable both emotionally and physically, and if you love yourself deeply, then this is not the book for you. And as a side note, congratulations! You have managed to create inner strength, comfort, and expression as a sexual woman, despite potent media messages to the contrary. That is something to be celebrated. However, I believe most of us in the United States are learning, experiencing, and expressing female sexuality in ways that don't work for us. We may simply want to know what a normal sex life is and how to fit into that norm. But what if the norm is a messed up, unhappy, and unfulfilled sex life? Because that is the norm for many women. Normal doesn't sound so appealing now, does it? But we can change that. The importance of self-worth. Five women of various ages sat in a circle in uncomfortable folding chairs. At 31, I appeared to be the youngest there. The small room was just a few steps off the sidewalk, and I glanced up as a group of teenagers walked, chatting, past our open door. Perhaps just enjoying the sunny Sunday afternoon, or more likely, walking to the nearby Starbucks for a caffeine and sugar fix. "Please close your eyes now," our workshop facilitator instructed, pulling my attention back to the group. I didn't really like her so far. She had what felt like a faux spiritual personality, but I had paid my $20, so I was going to get the most out of my 2 hours. We Gonzaleses are a frugal people. The leader, her voice calm and monotone, continued. "Place your hand over your heart. Concentrate on opening your heart center. Think about what you love about yourself. Imagine it. Visualize it. Feel it." I started thinking about how proud I was that I had driven cross-country alone, that I appreciated how quickly I was able to make new friends, that I loved spending time with my boyfriend, that, uh-oh, damn it, why are there tears again? I don't want to cry in front of these strangers. As I continued to visualize what I liked about myself and felt a lightness of gratitude and joy in my chest, those feelings quickly mixed with a dampening pressure on my heart. I had no control over my flowing tears. A few minutes later, we were asked to open our eyes. "Who would like to share?" our facilitator asked gently. I knew that I should share about my experience with the group. I had been quiet so far, and it was clear something was going on for me now. I could feel the burden of expectation from the group, or at least I thought I could. I had been reading about and practicing mindfulness for a few months since moving to San Diego, and I was taking this women's workshop for personal growth and empowerment. But the dancing, prickly feeling in my solar plexus and the nausea in my belly, bodily sensations I would learn in later years, meant I had a fear of feeling embarrassed and being judged, had kept my lips sealed. Yet without another thought, I now raised my hand. "You can probably see my tears." The words tumbled out of my mouth as I looked around the room, avoiding eye contact. "I'm not sure why this happens, but in the past couple of months, every time I meditate on self-love, I start crying. So clearly something is going on. I think I feel sad thinking about self-love because there are parts of me I don't love." Acknowledging this made me cry harder as the other participants looked at me through kind eyes. This would be the first of many public vulnerability moments for me, as my personal growth led me along a new path into mindfulness and authenticity. I was raised a good girl in a small town in Pennsylvania outside of Philadelphia. I was outspoken at a young age, with a sense of fairness and kindness, especially around perceived injustices. For example, a classmate picking on the new boy in class. But I also followed the rules of being a good girl, in terms of being obedient and not rocking the boat. At a young age, I had internalized messages about the danger of getting pregnant from sex. I was a responsible kid. In November of 1991, my freshman year at Lehigh University, I recall watching the television in my dorm room when Magic Johnson announced that he was retiring from basketball because he was HIV positive. This announcement propelled conversations about HIV and AIDS to a new level in the United States. The good girl in me heard the hidden message loud and clear. Sex was not just irresponsible. It could be deadly. By the end of my sophomore year, I had joined the campus club for sexual health peer educators. We presented condom demonstrations and sexually transmitted disease prevention workshops on campus. I was quickly intrigued by gender differences in sex and sexual decision-making, and the power dynamics that seem to exist between women and men in the sexual realm. I went on to graduate school at the State University of New York at Albany, and my research for my PhD dissertation in sociology focused on HIV prevention programs and adult women's sexual health education. I traveled to 5 cities around New York State to interview educators and community-based organizations, CBOs, who worked to halt the spread of HIV in their local communities. This was the early 2000s, when the spread and impact of HIV and AIDS in ethnic minority communities was finally being recognized by government agencies with funding for education. I was 30 years old, educated, white, suburban-raised, non-religious, a woman visiting CBOs primarily located in poorer Black, Latino, or Asian immigrant city neighborhoods. The educators were mostly members of the communities they served, and some were HIV positive. They kindly opened their doors to me, engaging in interviews about their educational efforts, and allowing me to observe their community HIV prevention workshops. These visits to CBOs and community spaces were an invaluable aspect of my professional and personal growth. 36 educators answered my questions about a variety of topics related to culture, gender, power, religion, and safer sex. Among other questions, I asked, "If you only had time to stress one thing regarding sexual health or prevention for women, what would that be?" The responses really surprised me. From my sexual health education training in college and graduate school, I assumed the primary answer would pertain to condom use. A few educators did say something along those lines, but the majority said they would emphasize self-worth, self-esteem, self-love, and the need for women to nurture or prioritize themselves. I didn't understand this at first. How was that going to help with preventing HIV? But this was the seed for me to recognize that at the core of overall sexual health is our feeling of worthiness. Think about it this way. If you don't think you're good enough or worthy enough to avoid HIV, why would you ask your sexual partner to use a condom or to discuss sexual health? Why would you care enough to take care of yourself, or even believe you have the ability to do so? Why would you ask for your needs to be met? After completing my field interviews and defending my dissertation proposal, I moved to San Diego, California, to complete my analysis and writing from afar in much warmer and sunnier weather. The timing was fortuitous in terms of understanding these confusing responses about self-love and self-worth. In San Diego, I joined local holistic health groups and mind-body-spirit communities, and attended classes in mindfulness, meditation, yoga, Reiki, energy work, life coaching, and personal transformation. Exposure to these new ways of thinking and moving through the world, based on mindfulness, compassion, authenticity, and vulnerability, was both terrifying and liberating. I came face to face with my own fears around self-love and self-worth. And I finally started to understand what those educators already knew. Self-worth is necessary for a healthy and fulfilling relationship and sex life. Author and researcher Brené Brown, Ph.D., headquartered at the University of Houston, writes and speaks widely about issues of vulnerability and self-worth. In her research, she discovered quite unexpectedly that shame is a heavy emotion that undermines worthiness, and lack of worthiness feeds shame. She writes, "Shame is basically the fear of being unlovable. It's the total opposite of owning your story and feeling worthy." In fact, the definition of shame that I developed from my research is, "Shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging." Ironically, because Brown personally struggled with and resisted her own vulnerability, she was dismayed by her own research, which found that allowing oneself to feel vulnerable was the key to real happiness. Having the courage, compassion, and connection to practice vulnerability is the only way to build worthiness. In all my work with women who are dealing with sexual issues, from individual and couples coaching to small group workshops and large lectures, worthiness is at the crux of my work. So many of us are undermined and sucked into belief systems that put us in constant battle with our bodies and our sexuality. But if we claim our worthiness, take it as a fact, instead of basing it on performing to appease others, we suddenly have time and space to just be ourselves. How do we claim our worthiness when we have so many external messages and internal beliefs that discourage it? The best way I have learned to move through shame to worthiness and to practice the courage, compassion, and connection that Brown speaks of is through full-body mindfulness. My personal introduction to mindfulness. The first time I learned about mindfulness was in January 2004, having moved to San Diego from the Northeast 2 months earlier. San Diego has a thriving holistic health and yoga community, so in the spirit of when in Rome, it wasn't long before I attended my first meditation class. Plus, I had made a promise to myself that I had to keep. Our instructor guided the class of six or so to find comfortable seats on cushions, then to close our eyes for her guided mindfulness meditation. I felt like a fish out of water. I kept peeking to see what others were doing and how they looked. One young man stood out to me. He looked like a good meditator because of his erect posture and apparent focus. To my surprise, no one else was peeking. I guessed I was supposed to trust the situation and just go along with it. In retrospect, I realized I was feeling silly and afraid to embarrass myself by doing something wrong in a new environment. Now, I look forward to opportunities to practice calm awareness in the community of others. Why did I seek a mindfulness meditation class in the first place? The 3 months leading up to my cross-country move had been stressful. In the chaos of moving from my apartment in Albany back to my parents' house in Pennsylvania, meeting a new boyfriend, completing my dissertation fieldwork, defending my proposal, and delaying my San Diego move by a month to get everything done, I experienced strong chest pains. I knew the cause was anxiety, but the pain really hurt. I also knew that deep breathing and visualizations could help, but I had little practice in cultivating these skills. I made a promise to myself that I would never again allow emotional stress to cause physical pain in such a way. One of my goals in moving to California, the la-la land of fruits and nuts, right? Was to explore some new age ideas and learn how to reduce my anxiety and feelings of being overwhelmed. I was definitely in the right place. Over the years, I've learned that mindful awareness is the foundation for all of my personal growth. And in the long run, it has helped me feel happier and calmer. I've learned to exercise choice in moments when I did not know I even had options. And I consider that the epitome of empowerment. In the short run, though, from battlefield to battlefield, such awareness can feel scary, confusing, painful, and deeply uncomfortable. It is this discomfort, and learning how to stay present with this discomfort in new ways, that has been my path to living a life of intention and choice. This path has been so very different from the reactivity and programming that previously ran the show, with behaviors that proved problematic in my relationships, intimate interactions, and life overall. Why this topic? As I was completing my dissertation, I started teaching small spiritual sexuality workshops for women in my home. And I continued my personal training around mindfulness by attending a 5-day retreat with the world-renowned mindfulness teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh. The next year, I delved into the personal transformation classes of Landmark Education and conducted interviews with 35 women about their sexuality as part of one of my class projects. I've pulled 2 relevant questions from these interviews and shared their responses in Chapter 6. At this point, some friends and acquaintances started asking if I would coach or counsel them around their sex, dating, and gender concerns. In this way, I was making a transition from graduate studies in academia to my own version of applied sociology in the sex and gender realm, and using mindfulness as the core of this approach. In December of 2012, I channeled all these topics of interest into my first TEDx talk, Sex, Mindful or Mindful. This talk explored the state of female sexuality in America and offered mindfulness tools for women to reclaim their sexual experiences and power. The positive feedback from men and women, both at the event and afterwards, further confirmed that I had struck a chord in our culture's zeitgeist. People saw how women were trained to dislike and disconnect from their own bodies and sexual experiences, and how mindfulness offered a new path for healing and growth. A couple years later, I gave a second TEDx talk, this one about how various examples of female sexual disempowerment around the world are all linked to shame, and how this emotion controls women's minds and bodies. My workshops, coaching practice, TEDx talks, and all of the subsequent feedback led me to write this book to explore the themes of female sexuality, desire, shame, mindfulness, and community responsibility. Why sex matters. Sex is powerful. People sometimes do really foolish things in the sexual realm, primarily because it validates that they are attractive, desirable, worthy, or powerful. Think about powerful politicians or religious leaders who lost their careers because of their sexual secrets, which were often in direct opposition to how they told others to live. Their sexuality, their need to be sexual, experience eroticism, express their sexual desires, or perhaps prove their masculinity or femininity through sexual conquest, drove them to risk it all. Because sexual energy is so powerful, it can bring out the worst
and best in us. When it is respectful, chosen, and connected, it gives us
sample complete. Ready to continue?